Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Politicians pull back the curtain and put on a show. What did we see? 6 hours of policy wonking, a few minutes of posturing, starring the president and a cast of both parties.
We don't care for this bill. I think you know that. The American people don't care for the bill. I think that we've demonstrated in the polling that they don't.
That's Republican Whip Eric Cantor. And how did the audience react? We checked in with our listeners.
I don't know that anyone watching that could have come away thinking that much was accomplished.
I was disappointed in that entire bill that has been worked through the legislative process over the last year. They want it completely thrown out, which really shows no chance of compromise.
So what's the next act? We'll find out on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Friday, February 26th. I'm Lynn Scherr in for Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, Lynn. It's great to have you here. Let's get right to the top stories we're following this morning, and you alluded to one right there at the top. President Obama says it's the time for talking about health reform is over.
We cannot have another year-long debate about this.
Well, they talked for about 7 hours yesterday, and near the end of the televised healthcare summit conference, the president told Republicans if they can't compromise, Democrats will move forward with the bill with or without their support. Republican Senator Lamar Alexander of Tennessee says his party wants a do-over.
Our view, with all respect, is that this is a car that can't be recalled and fixed and that we ought to start over. But we'd like to start over.
Democrats will reportedly wait until next week to see if there's any change to the gridlock.
For a quick recap, we are joined by Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick. Good morning, Todd.
Hi, good morning, Lynn.
Todd, there were a lot of speeches and gimmicks yesterday. Were they, in fact, talking to each other?
Well, they were talking to each other, but only for a minority of the time because there are so many different audiences. They were playing to their political bases. Barack Obama was playing to some of the Democrats in his own party who don't want to follow him on this bill. Republicans were playing to Tea Party people who they want to try to get into the fold for the next election. And they were playing to the cameras, of course, the news media. So sometimes you're playing to the back of the room, sometimes to the wings, sometimes to the balcony. Lots of audiences in that room.
And we are going to talk about much more. Stay with us, Todd. We'll be back with you in just a moment.
Suicide bombers struck at the heart of Afghanistan this morning. A series of explosions and gun battles killed at least 18 people in Kabul. The target was a row of hotels used by Indian embassy workers. The Taliban is claiming responsibility. Here at home, the Veterans Affairs Department is going to bat for soldiers who suffer from what's commonly called Gulf War illness. The VA says it will re-examine the disability claims of what could be thousands of veterans, the first step toward potentially compensating them nearly two decades after that war ended. Interesting story on the front cover of the New York Times this morning. The White House wants to use the government's buying power to prod companies to improve wages and benefits for millions of workers. It's altering the way it awards $500 billion in federal contracts each year and plans to disqualify companies with labor or environmental violations. Nearly one in four American workers are employed under some federal contract.
And if you're counting, another big day for Team USA at the Olympics, four medals overall. The U.S. took both the gold and silver in the Nordic combined, with Bill DeMong finishing on top.
I don't think either of us really cared who won or got second, and I honestly didn't know what place it was going to be until about the last 2 seconds.
The women's hockey team, however, lost their gold medal to Canada. That is to say, lost the gold medal game. No medals for American women figure skaters. Favorite Kim Yuna of South Korea didn't just win gold, she got a near-perfect score. In the markets, Asian and European markets are up. Futures are up. The Dow gets underway at 10,321. The S&P opens at 1,102. And the NASDAQ opens at 2,234.
Lots on the show. Stay tuned. Movies, trivia, and in our series Frustration Nation, we're amending the Constitution. How would you amend the Constitution? Post it to our website, 8778MyTake or thetakeaway.org. The Healthcare Summit in Washington coming up.
Hi, Hi, I'm Lynn Scherr, in for Celeste Headlee for a few days on
Good
The Takeaway.
Morning, Lynn.
Good morning,
great
John.
To have you here.
Lovely to be with you. Thank you so much.
Snowy day in New York.
It's a miserable day
yes,
in New York.
Indeed.
But we're nice and cozy inside, and we have great stuff to talk about. For example, they were at it for more than 6 hours yesterday.
What were they doing? It seemed like they were shooting campaign commercials, if you ask me.
Well, in fact, John, the cameras were rolling. It was, as we say, a spirited debate about the president's proposal for health care reform. And, John, at its heart, it was democracy in action.
This is such a complicated issue that it's inevitably going to be contentious. But what I'm hoping to accomplish today is for everybody to focus not just on where we differ, but focus on where we agree. Because there actually is some significant agreement on a host of issues.
But all that talk about bipartisanship resulted in very little compromise, at least publicly. Joining us to review the proceedings is Takeaway's Washington correspondent, Todd Zwillick, who followed every lively minute of the day-long forum. And Lori Robertson is also with us. She's managing editor for factcheck.org and head of our Truth Squad this morning. Welcome to both of you.
Good morning, Lynn.
Todd, let me start with you. Republicans said they wanted to scratch the bill and start all over again. Here's Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell.
Every American cares deeply about the quality of their health care and access to health care and cost of health care. They have followed this debate like no other, and they have rendered a judgment about what we have attempted to do so far. The solution to that is to put that on the shelf and to start over.
Todd, talking about starting over doesn't sound like much of a compromise.
No, and it's not going to happen, and if that's what Republicans expect, they know they won't get it from the Democrats. The Democrats have made clear that they're willing to, at least they say they're willing to make some changes to the plan that they have, but that this is the plan they were going with. You know, this whole event, Lynn, as a political event, was extraordinary. Both sides, live on television, going at each other. There were some areas of that looked like they could be common agreement, like cracking down on waste and fraud in the medical in the medical system, you know, going after the money that we spend on things that don't really go towards treating people or keeping them well. But in Washington, that stuff is low-hanging fruit. And this event was never going to be a negotiating session. It was never intended to be that. If anyone expected them to shake hands at the end and have a bill, that was never going to happen. But it allowed both sides, I think, to appear engaged in the debate. The president took away all of the objections that he's not willing to negotiate or compromise, or that this whole process has been closed. Here was a process that was live on TV. At the same time, the Republicans take away the accusations that they don't have a plan. They did present a plan. They told the president, here's what we would like to do. We would like to let people buy insurance across state lines. We would like to have meaningful caps on lawsuits against doctors, things as well.
And they did it, Todd, in a very different format than we're used to watching, certainly on television. And by the way, not everyone was always on their best behavior.
Let me just make this point, John, because we're not campaigning anymore. The election's over.
I'm reminded of that every day.
Obviously, the two contenders for the presidency, John McCain, President Obama. So other than that kind of thing, Todd, were there, in fact, some real points made?
Sure. I mean, there were real points made on both sides. And I thought the most interesting part of this was, frankly, the posturing, because, again, this was a political event. Democrats kept saying, we're just so close. We agree on so much. And the message there, the subtext is, if you Republicans would just give a little bit, we can get a bill for the American people. The Republicans know what their message is. This bill is unpopular, Mr. President. Scrap it and start over. Those are two political messages playing to two very separate groups of people. If those are the messages going in, they were never going to reach an agreement.
Lori, let me go over to you now, our fact checker, Lori Robertson. One of the big issues that came up early was whether the president's proposal would lower premiums. Here's what Republican Senator Lamar Alexander said, followed by the response by President Obama.
It means there'll be about $500 billion of new taxes in it. It means that for millions of Americans, premiums will go up because when people pay those new taxes.
Even without the subsidies, it's estimated by the Congressional Budget Office that the plan we put forward would lower
the costs in the individual market for the average person who's just trying to buy health insurance and they're not lucky enough to work for a big company would lower their costs by between 14 and 20%. So, Lamar, when you mentioned earlier that you said premiums go up, that's just not the case.
Lori Robertson, who's right, who's wrong on this one?
Well, actually, they're both being misleading. And, of course, the truth here is a little bit complicated. But the Congressional Budget Office looked at the Senate bill, which is largely similar to the president's plan, and found that really there would be no significant change in premiums for those who are in group policies, those who get their insurance through their employer. But for those in the individual market, people who buy coverage on their own, they would see an average premium hike of between 10% and 13%. There's a little bit of a but there. The reason that those premiums are going up so much in the individual market is because the benefits are going to get a heck of a lot better. And part of that is the mandate that plans have a certain level of benefits. And the other reason, the CBO said, is because a lot of people in that individual market are going to get subsidies. About 57% of them are going to get subsidies, and that kind of prompts people to get a better plan than they normally would.
So as you say, complicated. No surprise that that both sides were a little off on that one. Let me give you another one, Lori. Soon after that, Republican Senator Tom Coburn said this about spending.
The government now directs over 60% of the health care in this country.
Lori Robertson, true or false?
Well, it's not really true. Sorry about that. I can't give you a straight yes or no. Really, the figure's about 47%, but Coburn had asked for a study that adds in a bunch of other stuff that you normally wouldn't include, lost tax revenue due to charitable contributions and lost tax revenue due to deals that employers get for offering coverage. So his figure's inflated.
It is complex, as I say. Little wonder they don't stick to the pure facts. Todd, what happens next?
Well, the president said at the end of this meeting, I'll give it 6 weeks for you guys to see if you're going to compromise. If not, we're going to ram this home.
Okay. Todd Zwillick in Washington, Lori Robertson, thanks for your help. Let's check in on stories we're following at 15 minutes after the hour.
Afghan President Hamid Karzai has condemned today's suicide attacks in the center of Kabul. He also expressed sadness for at least 18 people who were killed. The Taliban claimed responsibility and say five suicide bombers conducted the attack. Meanwhile, in the south of the country, the city of Marja is nearly free of insurgents, but Pentagon spokesman Jeff Morrell says the area is still littered with explosives.
We're still losing troops, and the biggest threat to them remains IED. So we have to be very careful about how we progress into those areas that are not under Afghan and coalition control.
NATO says another service member was killed today by one of those IEDs.
Back home, John, House leaders have thrown out plans to vote on a major jobs bill today. The Senate passed the same bill on Wednesday, but various Democratic factions have objected to some of the proposals. Meanwhile, the Senate failed to extend benefits, to extend programs for laid-off workers yesterday. That's bad news for some of the unemployed who will see their benefits expire this weekend. Democrats could not overcome the objections of a Kentucky senator who said the $10 billion bill would add to the budget deficit.
In the Northeast, travel is disrupted. 500,000 people are without power thanks to another major winter storm. Weather Channel meteorologist Chris Warren told NBC getting around isn't easy today.
People trying to get into the Northeast today going to have an extremely difficult time flying in. And people here on the East Coast definitely sick of this winter weather.
Oh, he's way out on a limb there. Slow-moving storm is expected to continue well into the weekend. That's a look at some of the stories we're watching this morning. Coming up, we'll give you the latest results from women's hockey and figure skating. Jason Stallman from the New York Times Olympic editor joins us in a few minutes.
Hey, you want that to go?
News takeouts. Now, you've been watching the Olympics, right, Lynn?
Every single minute.
Do you know the difference between the short program and the long program? In figure skating?
Do you want me to be really nasty one of them's longer than the other?
Somebody has to explain this to me. For our first takeout, we begin at the Olympics in Vancouver, Canada. Jason Stallman, Olympics editor for our partner, the New York Times. Good morning, Jason.
Good morning, John.
Now, this is our last day of Olympics coverage, but there are events all through the weekend, right?
Absolutely. The climax.
But last night was a pretty big event. The women's figure skating wrapped up with the long program. What's the difference between the long program and the short program again?
It's a little bit longer.
I see. Thank you very much. We've seen your real go-for-broke performances. South Korea's Yuna skating flawlessly. Joanne Rochette, best program in her life. I loved Mira Nagasu of the U.S. skating through that nosebleed. How did the long program stack up to the competition in the short program?
Long program was pretty spectacular. A couple days ago, I think when we talked, I likened Kim Yuna's performance in the short program to what we saw 2 years ago in Beijing from Usain Bolt. And tonight really reinforced that, or last night rather. What she's doing in figure skating right now is what Bolt did in sprinting. She's completely turning the sport on its head. She won by a massive margin, more than 23 points. Consider this, if she had competed among the men in the Vancouver Olympics this year, she would have finished ninth.
Wow.
That's absolutely unthinkable in figure skating.
Now, is this because of a stylistic sort of approach, or is it piling on the technical flawlessness?
It's both. It's primarily piling on the technical component. She's doing things that simply no other people can do. But on top of that, she's so artistic that the judges reward her somewhat subjectively for that as well. But she's just superior in every way.
And the U.S. women, you know, don't have much of a chance in this event.
No, the U.S. women were really not strong medal contenders, but they performed well. Mariah Nagasu, a very young, promising skater, she finished fourth just out of the medal contention, so there is hope.
Yesterday we were talking about the Canadian men in hockey beating the Russians as feeling to the Canadians like a gold medal match all by itself, but it was really pretty spectacular with the women last night.
Canadian women look strong. They really outperformed the American women from start to finish. They win 2-0 and take the gold medal. And Canada has a real strong run of female gold medals at this point. It's really their female athletes that are carrying them across the board. Of course, their men in hockey can still win a gold.
I mean, there was a real U.S. women's hockey juggernaut going until the Canadian shutout. Were you surprised by the shutout?
Not terribly surprised. You know, this is a sport like women's softball that it's dominated by two teams. I think there's real concern at this point whether it can last on the Olympic program. It's just not a viable sport worldwide at this point. Canada and the U.S. are the dominant forces, and it just went down to those two.
Although, you know, the U.S. is not being a very good neighbor to the South. I mean, in terms of medal count, where do we stand at this point?
U.S. is having a great Olympics. U.S. officials have to be happy at this point. They're on top of the medal table. You know, they haven't won the overall medal count at a Winter Olympics in 80 years or so. 1932, Lake Placid was
wow.
The last time. They have 32 total medals right now. Interestingly, what you're going to see happen over the next few days is a discussion about whether you go by total medals or total gold medals.
Right.
U.S. has 8 gold medals, so does Canada right now.
Well, there's neck and neck. Jason Stallman, Olympics editor for our party, The New York Times, winding up our Olympics coverage in Vancouver. Still a weekend of competition ahead. Thanks so much, Jason.
And John, it is Friday, and for our last takeout, we look at the lucky and unlucky in the news. In cooperation with our friends at The Week magazine, it is time for Good Week, Bad Week. It was a good week for typos on the internet, specifically.
When is it not a good week?
Well, you know, have you ever misspelled a website in your browser? I bet you have.
Occasionally.
More often than not, you wind up on a site with a bunch of links on it. Well, some of those links get you to where you want to go, and all of them are ads.
Looks like advertisers pay Google something like $500 million per year for typo-squatting traffic, that is, for their ads to appear when users mistype the addresses of just the very most famous sites.
Typo squatting, what a
typo
cool
squatting.
Word. Yep, that is Harvard professor Ben Edelman, and he has filed a suit against Google, saying they are profiting unfairly from this practice of typo squatting. How come? Why is typo squatting a problem?
Well, it certainly is a problem for the poor advertisers. The advertisers end up paying to get traffic that really ought to be free. And ultimately, of course, consumers pay the advertisers who pay Google. So anything the advertisers are paying, ultimately that comes out of consumers' pockets.
Good week for typos. Also good week
also
for Google figuring
yeah,
out how
right.
to make $500 million out of misspelling. That's pretty good. It is a bad week, however, for Cleveland. Forbes magazine just came up with their misery index. It measures the awfulness of cities on Forbes magazine's misery index. And we caught up with Forbes senior editor Kurt Bodenhausen, who broke down how they decided Cleveland was the most miserable.
We looked at 9 metrics. They included commute times, weather, violent crimes, unemployment, both income and sales taxes, as well as how pro sports teams performed. Cities up at the top were bunched actually pretty closely together the way we scored it. But Cleveland moved up from 4th last year to 1st this year.
Ouch. Oh, I mean,
poor Cleveland.
Yeah, that's the last thing Cleveland needs. Yeah. A bad week to be number one. Cleveland didn't take the abuse lightly. The mayor's chief of staff, Ken Silliman, spoke with us yesterday. He says that a miserable city list that also has New York and Philadelphia among the top 10 needs to be reexamined.
This isn't just about Cleveland taking offense to being number one. Rather, what we are saying in Cleveland is, how reliable is this index you created if our company on the top 10 worst list are some of the most attractive urban areas in the country?
And let's be fair. I mean, a subscriber to Forbes, what's miserable to a person like that? I mean, basically, like, a waitress is late to your table.
Do you think any of them has ever been to Cleveland?
Indeed. 8778, my take. Your nominations for Good Week or Bad Week are at thetakeaway.org. And the full Good Week, Bad Week feature in The Week magazine is on newsstands now. Coming up, New Orleans cover up uncovered. Coming up, the story of a police cover-up in the aftermath of Katrina. That's about the triumph of journalism. More in a few minutes. Right now, let's check in on top news stories at 30 minutes after the hour. President Obama is sending Republicans a strong signal that Democrats will move forward on health care reform with or without them.
Is there enough serious effort that in a month's time or a few weeks' time or 6 weeks' time, we could actually resolve something? And if we can't, then I think we've got to go ahead and make some decisions, and then that's what elections are for.
Republican position, let's start over again.
The United Nations is criticizing Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi this morning over his calls for a holy war against Switzerland. Gaddafi made the call in response to a recent Swiss ban on the building of minarets. This morning, Vice President Joe Biden is proposing legislation to protect workers' retirement savings. Under the vice president's proposal, advisors and money managers will have to base investment advice on objective computer models, and they won't be allowed to steer workers into funds they are affiliated with. Okay, who is the top superhero of all time, the Man of Steel or the Dark Knight? According to comic book sales, we have a new champion. Just 3 days after a Superman issue became the first comic book to sell for $1 million, a Batman comic sold yesterday for about $75,000 more.
Whoa.
It is a rare copy of Detective Comics number 27, where Batman made his debut back in 1939. Back then, the comic sold for 10 cents.
Kerpow. Let's check the markets. Asian and European markets are up. Futures are up. The Dow will get underway happily at 10,321. The S&P opens at 1,102. And the NASDAQ opens at 2,234. Those are some of the stories we're watching this morning. So remember when Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans, the storm's fury was also something of a smokescreen of chaos. It hid in the lawlessness some of the worst abuses by medical workers, some law enforcement, and others. And this curtain enabled people to elude justice for years, until, at least in one case, yesterday.
Today is a dark and disappointing day for the citizens of New Orleans, especially for the honest and dedicated members of the New Orleans Police Department.
That was New Orleans Police Chief Warren Riley at a news conference yesterday, responding to the decision by former police lieutenant Michael Lohman to plead guilty to federal charges of conspiracy, admitting that he helped cover up for officers who opened fire on unarmed civilians, killing 2 in the chaos that ensued amid the hurricane. Police shot 6 unarmed civilians crossing the Danziger Bridge, killing 19-year-old James Brissett and a mentally disabled 40-year-old man, Ronald Madison. The guilty plea is a triumph for the traditional journalists who worked for some non-traditional institutions and stayed on this case despite the odds. And 2 of them join us. Steve Engenberg is the managing director of ProPublica, a nonprofit investigative newsroom. ProPublica teamed up with the New Orleans Times-Picayune for nearly 2 years to cover the police violence that ensued in the wake of Katrina. And also joining us from New Orleans is Donatus King, president of the NAACP's New Orleans branch. Good morning to both of you. Steve, Donatus.
Good morning.
First of all, Steve, why did ProPublica and the journalists who are responsible for uncovering this stay on the case, and just lead us through the story as best you can?
Well, first of all, it's a little bit more complicated than that. What happened here is that this incident on the Danziger Bridge was a very well-known incident, and in its immediate aftermath, as we've now learned from this plea, there was a pretty massive cover-up. State charges were eventually brought in the city of New Orleans and then later dropped because the prosecutor had botched this. And at that point, the New Orleans Times-Picayune stayed on the case, eventually prompting a lot of additional investigation by the FBI and the federal authorities. Now, what we have done with the Times-Picayune is stayed on the case more broadly of what happened, because this isn't the only case. With the Times-Picayune and Frontline, we have identified a number of instances in which police, after Katrina, shot at civilians, killing them, wounding them, and then engaged in investigations that were very, very questionable. In this case, we now learn the investigation was actually entirely a cover-up.
Right, and Steve Engelberg there is referring to a Times-Picayune and WGBH and ProPublica documentary on Frontline, a PBS documentary that attempts to figure out what happened in the chaos after Katrina. You know, in some sense, Donatus King, this opens a lot of wounds in the community of New Orleans. Describe your chief concerns about how this is going to, reveal all kinds of revelations as the testimony in the case goes forward.
Well, for one, we're glad in the community that this information is coming out, but it's nothing that's really new. It's being confirmed now from insiders. From the very beginning, there are questions that have been raised about the Danziger incident and the other incidents that that we just talked about. The NAACP, from the very beginning, met with the Madison family, the others that were involved, has complained to the not only the U.S. attorney, but also the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department, trying to get the light shined on these incidents. And finally now we see the fruit of it, that the light is being shined. But as far as where we are right now, there's some relief that this information is coming out, but it raises other questions, and it's our hopes that this investigation will be even broadened. And when I say that, it was mentioned just a second ago about a mistake that was made by the district attorney's office that allowed the charges to be dropped against the shooters. Well, there are some questions right now as to whether or not that was a mistake or whether or not that was part of a conspiracy to have these charges dismissed, because one of the people that were involved in that mistake by the district attorney is the same officer that has now pled guilty to being a part of the conspiracy. This investigation, it should broaden, including going into the criminal court. The judge that presided over this criminal matter, there were many linkages between him, his staff, and the defendants. So it's still another unanswered question.
Right, and a lot of those questions are going to be traumatic for the community, who's going to have to be rehashing all of the events of Katrina. That's Donatus King, president of the NAACP's New Orleans branch. Steve Engelberg, what are the resources of ProPublica, a nonprofit investigative newsroom, and the Times-Picayune journalistically that kept this case going, where maybe in other communities it wouldn't have proceeded?
Well, first of all, I mean, the Times-Picayune has had two reporters on this from the very beginning, in addition to which our reporter, A.C. Thompson, first working independently with a grant from the Nation Institute and later as our reporter, has dogged this story for 2.5 years. And now Frontline has joined us with a reporter as well. I just want to point out what Mr. King said, very important here. This story is so wild. Police writing false reports, police supervisors participating in planting guns and cover-ups, that you can now, I think, as a citizen of New Orleans, literally believe anything.
and it wouldn't be too far-fetched.
Wow.
This is really an amazing. I urge people to go to ProPublica.org, read the document that charges this gentleman, and decide for yourself. This is like a wild movie in which everything you could imagine about a corrupt police force is actually happening.
And it's a fascinating story, which is the subject of Law and Disorder, the joint production of ProPublica, our partner WGBH in Boston, and the Times-Picayune in New Orleans, a frontline documentary that attempts to figure out what happened after Katrina. Thanks to Steve Engelberg, managing editor of ProPublica, and Donatus King, president of the NAACP's New Orleans branch. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Now to Kabul. Big story this morning. Militants have attacked hotels and guest houses. Suicide bombers responsible for at least 18 people dead, although the death toll has been moving all morning. Many more are injured. We spoke earlier with the BBC's Martin Patience in Kabul, who described the scene.
It's quiet now. This attack took place about 8 hours ago at about 6:30 local time, and I heard it as well. There was a huge explosion, and that explosion was most likely to have been caused by a car bomb. That was followed by two smaller blasts, and then there was sporadic gun battles in the city. Now, this attack took place in the heart of Kabul, close to a hotel called the Park Residence Hotel, which is frequented by Westerners and Indian workers, and as you pointed out, at least 17 people have been killed, including four Indians and one Italian, and over 30 others have been injured.
Now, Martin Patience, NATO officials are no doubt going to declare that this shows the Taliban's weakness, that they are perhaps defeated in Marja and Helmand province or in Kandahar. They can only respond in Kabul. Do you buy that analysis?
Well, the counter-argument is that the Taliban can strike at will in the Afghan capital, Kabul. We've seen that in the last 6 months. We've seen a step up in the number of attacks carried out by the Taliban here in Kabul. And the argument always is that you pressure the insurgency in the south and east of the country. That's where it's at its strongest, in Helmand and Kandahar. But the danger always is that the Taliban will strike elsewhere. And it seems to be clear that the Taliban are sending a clear message that while NATO forces may be attacking them, hitting them in the south and the east of the country, they can still attack in the capital and cause maximum casualties and destabilization here in the Afghan capital, which is supposed to be the most secure part of the country in many ways.
Although, Martin, as you've reported and your colleagues at the BBC have reported, that the government of Hamid Karzai and the reputation of NATO forces in Afghanistan is surprisingly resilient at this point. Is there some sort of built-in barrier to these kinds of bombings hurting the credibility of the Afghan government for a while?
Well, yeah, I think there is. I think many Afghans get angry when their own government can't protect them. I mean, there are security measures in this city. Its security is tight. There are hundreds of Afghan police and army personnel deployed in and around the city to try and prevent these types of attacks. But what we've seen in the last 6 months is that the Taliban and other insurgents increasingly seem to be getting through, and I think there'll be real security concerns. Because psychologically, this is a big impact. Because if the Afghan government can't secure the capital, how can it secure the rest of the country where the insurgency is seen as being stronger?
City tensions and country tensions there in Afghanistan. That was Martin Patience, BBC correspondent, speaking with us earlier from Kabul. We have reports that the attackers are apparently still in the city, at least some of them. The Taliban has claimed responsibility for this attack, and at this point, at least 18 are dead at a Kabul shopping center after a coordinated series of blasts. Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with Lynn Scherer, who's joining me for a few days while Celeste Headlee is on the phone. And it's time for trivia this morning. We got our movie segment coming right up, and let's get right to it. Three questions this morning. Oscar winner Peter Finch, whose voice we've been featuring all week in our Frustration Nation segments, you know, him screaming in the movie network.
Yeah, I've heard it.
I'm mad as hell. I'm not going to take it anymore. He holds an Oscar distinction. What is it? That's question number one. Number two, can you name the two actors who won Oscars for playing the same character? And name that character. It's a little harder. And then here's the hardest. Number three, who has the most statues in any category? Give us your guesses at our Facebook page, facebook.com/thetakeaway, or email mytakeatthetakeaway.org. Right now, here's a check on leading stories at 48 minutes after the hour. News out in the past few minutes, the economy rocketed ahead at a 5.9% growth rate at the end of 2009, stronger than first estimated, but the revised GDP spurt isn't expected to carry over into this year. Also this morning, AIG has reported a substantial fourth-quarter loss of nearly $9 billion. But hey, it's not as bad with the $62 billion the company lost the previous year. AIG attributed its loss to the cost of selling off parts of its insurance businesses, to reduce the debt it owes, guess what, taxpayers. The Winter Games in Vancouver will wrap up on Sunday. Skier Lindsey Vonn will race in the slalom competition, U.S. skier, wearing a plastic brace to protect her hurt finger. But that's not the only thing that's hurting Vonn. She says she was hurt by some of the comments made by fellow U.S. skier Julia Mancuso that Vonn was getting too much attention. Mancuso says reports that she was criticizing her teammate just aren't true.
The way it came across that it was a media attention fight or something like that is just ridiculous.
Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Let's go out to dinner and see a movie. Let's go out to dinner and see a movie.
Dinner, movie, trivia, Friday's movie day. Rafer Guzman, takeaway movie contributor and film critic for Newsday, is in the house, or at least on a landline. Good morning, Rafer.
Morning. How are you?
So we're counting down to the Oscars, right? A little over a week remains until the big night. I've been screaming over all the 10 best picture nominees this year, five animated features, all the regular categories as well. You can't see everything. So we want you to help us sort through what we should see between now and the Oscars and what we can leave behind. First of all,
right. I guess the most obvious one would be Avatar. That's going to be the ultimate water cooler movie of the year. You don't want to be the guy standing around clutching your coffee cup with nothing to say when everybody else is talking about Avatar. I think that's a must see.
Ladies and gentlemen, you are not in Kansas anymore. You are on Pandora.
Should see your faces.
We have an indigenous population called the Na'vi. They are very hard to kill.
Man, and just listening to audio does not really take you to where Avatar takes you.
But I see you in blue, John.
3D IMAX, yes. Nice nose there. What else, Rafer?
I think also I'd really like to push people to see The Hurt Locker, which is the other big frontrunner for Best Picture. This thing has only made $12 million so far. I mean, that's like the equivalent of 20 bucks in Hollywood terms. It still seems to be a typical Iraq war movie that nobody wants to go see.
$12 million? That's Cameron's, limo fee. Right.
Yeah, that's less than the production cost, I'm pretty sure. It's such an intense, such an incredibly well-directed movie. I really think people should get out there and see that film.
You've seen it, right, Lynn?
I have, and I thought it was just astounding. And by the way, when you were doing the news about Afghanistan today, you can't help thinking about that every
Indeed.
Time you hear
right.
the news.
No, it's absolutely iconic, unforgettable. You can't think about war in the same way if you've seen Hurt Locker. Okay, so you think that's a big front runner. What's a less obvious movie that people need to see?
A less obvious movie, one that's kind of going under the radar, I think, is An Education with Carey Mulligan, who's also up for an acting award as well. And that is a really great coming-of-age story. And you know what I liked about that movie was it's not the typical coming-of-age movie where the teen is this kind of likable hero and some bad things happen and she has to say, oh, well, life dealt me a few hard blows and I'll get over it. She makes a lot of really poor choices and brings a lot of bad things on herself and has to deal with it. And that seemed really realistic to me. And it occurred to me that the last time I saw a coming-of-age movie quite like that was The Graduate, where the hero
wow.
is really making some poor mistakes and has to kind of clean up his mess.
So he's saying see An Education. Lynn, is it just
yes.
because he's a youthful hipster?
I'm sure that he is a youthful hipster, but I would say the reason to see Education in addition is it is the flip side of Up in the Air.
Hmm. Oh, interesting.
And you have to see...
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Up in the Air, we'll talk about it in a moment. The characters weren't really terribly likable, but let's talk about the two movies you said, which is kind of surprising to me, you could actually skip. First, there's the obvious one, The Blind Side.
There is a huge difference between paying for a broken arm and being legally responsible for someone. I mean, a kid we barely know.
That's another thing.
We need to find out more about his past.
He won't talk about it. He's like an onion. You have to peel him back a layer at a time.
Not if you use a knife.
So skip the blind side?
I think you can skip the blind side. I don't quite understand why this is in the running for a best picture. I mean, it's amazing and everything that Sandra Bullock has got this, you know, best acting nomination. But I mean, if you go see the movie, it's not as though she's going to knock you out of your seat. I mean, we all know that she's a pretty good actor. She does a good job in the film, but it's really just a very typical middling movie, inspirational sports drama. Mm. White couple adopts the black teenager. There's just not anything that special about it.
All right, so typical movie and possibly a typical Hollywood backstory, which is why it's in Oscar contention. Precious, though. Skip Precious, really?
You know, here's what I'm saying about Precious. I'm a little on the fence about it. It's most people I talk to, when they say, should I see Precious? It looks so depressing. And I always think, well, it's not really a depressing movie. It does have a message of hope. It does have a message of triumph. It's got some amazing, amazing acting from people you'd never expect. Mariah Carey, for one. Monique, for another, obviously. But I think when all is said and done, it is kind of a typical urban message movie.
Lynn?
No, I'm sorry. I don't buy typical.
You disagree?
I disagree. I like what you said at the top. I agree with you totally that it is uplifting. I agree with you that the acting is out of the park. I don't think it's typical at all. I think it's definitely worth seeing.
All right. A couple of other recommendations that maybe are not so obvious. Rafer says we should see A Single Man. Colin Firth is up for Best Actor. Lynn, you say skip that.
Watching paint dry.
Okay. Rafer says, yes, see White Ribbon. That's up for Best Foreign Film. Why, Rafer?
You know, I thought that was a really, really interesting movie. Michael Haneke, a German director, he is, you know, he's always a little more question than answer, which sometimes leaves me frustrated. But this movie I thought was really effective. I mean, it takes place in a small German town on the eve of World War One. All these horrible things start happening.
Right.
It seems like the kids might be responsible. Mm. You're not quite sure. Usually Michael Haneke kind of frustrates me, but I found this one really effectively creepy and thought-provoking.
All right. White Ribbon. And you also recommend The Fantastic Mr. Fox, which is not a kid's movie, and I would recommend that as well. But it's trivia time, Rafer. You ready?
I think I'm ready.
All right, question number one. Oscar winner Peter Finch, we've been featuring his voice in our Frustration Nation segments all week.
Well, I'm not going to leave you alone. I want you to get mad.
All right, so he holds an Oscar distinction. What is it?
First posthumous Oscar winner?
Absolutely, you're right. Number two, okay. Can you name the two actors who won Oscars for playing the same character?
You know, I am not sure about that one. Is one of them Basil Rathbone?
No, absolutely not. Lynn, take it.
I know who it is.
Go, go.
The character is Don Corleone. Can you go from there, Rafer?
The two actors.
Oh, it's...
De Niro and Brando.
Now I'm going to blank on the...
I'm going to make him an offer to camera for you.
It's De Niro and Brando.
Okay.
Finally, okay, who has the most statues in any category?
I'm going to guess Hepburn. Catherine Hepburn?
No, it's Walt Disney. 26 total, including specials. And if you throw in the 7 little statues they gave him in 1938 for Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, it goes up to 33.
Yep.
Thanks, Rafer. Thanks so much.
Oh, go Dwarfs. If you want more movies, you can read a list of which Oscar-nominated movies to see or skip from Rafer and our producer, Kristen Meinzer. Just stop by thetakeaway.org and click on blog. And while you're there, catch up on anything you missed by getting our podcast. That's at thetakeaway.org.
Kristen and Rafer are trying to take over the world. If you check out that podcast, it's pretty amazing. While you're there, we have something for you cat owners. We held our own contest during the Westminster Dog Show. We heard from cat owners who wanted their own competition. Well, we answered your meows. Cat owners, send in your photos for the Takeaway Cat Show. Post your cat photos to our Facebook page. Go to our site for directions, thetakeaway.org. Next week, we'll hold a vote on the best ones. You can still participate in Frustration Nation. How do you fix the U.S. Constitution if that's what it takes to break gridlock? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post to our site, thetakeaway.org. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Lynn Sherrin for Celeste Headley. This is The Takeaway.
The U.S. Constitution. We've been amending and upgrading it since the 1700s, just not recently.
Yo, start with 11, go on to 27. Going step by step with the rest of the
In the frustration nation called America, does the U.S. Constitution need a new look? What tool do we have to get the gridlock out of American democracy?
With a squeak and a point and a rickety pop, it'll take anything and fix it right up. The Fix-It Machine! The Fix-It Machine!
A Fix-It Machine for the Constitution? The Founding Fathers may not have contemplated Dora the Explorer, but a constitutional convention to deal with divided government? This house is in order. We're taking your amendments now. Operators are standing by on the takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. It's Friday, February 26th. Yes, we do have a constitutional convention in order. I'm John Hockenberry, joined by Lynn Scherr and for Celeste Headlee for a few days.
Morning, John. Let's get right to the top stories we're following this morning. New economic numbers out in the past hour show the economy grew at a rate of 5.9% in the final quarter of last year. That is better than expected, but economists do not think the growth spurt will carry over into this year. Also out this morning, insurance giant AIG reported a $9 billion loss for the last quarter.
President Obama is sending Republicans strong signals that Democrats will move forward on a health care overhaul with or without them.
With respect to the most contentious issue, I'm not sure we can bridge the gap.
In response, Republican Senator John McCain told Fox News this morning,
there are areas we can find common ground, but let's do it step by step. The president portrays it sort of as his way or the highway, and that's not what we want to do.
But to pass the bill, Democrats would have to use a special budget process called reconciliation, which forces a majority vote. Well, reconciliation might break a deadlock, but maybe Congress needs a bigger solution. We're going to talk about that a little later this morning. The U.S. government might need a constitutional amendment. And joining us now is Nate Persily, professor of law at Columbia and a friend of our program. Professor, what is it take to amend, to actually update the Constitution itself?
Well, there are two routes specified in Article 5 of the Constitution. One is that whenever two-thirds of both houses of Congress, the House and the Senate, deem it necessary, they can propose amendments to the Constitution, which then get ratified by three-fourths of the states, either in their state legislatures or in the convention. The other route, which has never been successful, is that two-thirds of the state legislatures can ask that a convention be called, and then the amendments from that would then be ratified.
Or we could do it on a radio program. Keep your own amendment in mind. We're going to talk about how we might end gridlock by amending the Constitution in just a moment, Nate Persily.
The streets of Kabul were a battleground this morning. Suicide bombers triggering a series of explosions and gun battles that killed at least 17 people, probably 18, in the Afghan capital. The target was a row of hotels used by Indian embassy workers. The Taliban is claiming responsibility. Earlier on The Takeaway, the BBC's Martin Patience in Kabul told us the attack is a message from the Taliban.
While NATO forces may be attacking them, hitting them in the south and the east of the country, they can still attack in the capital and cause maximum casualties.
At least two of the attackers were killed.
Hundreds of flights have been canceled. 500,000 customers are without power this morning in the northeast thanks to another major winter storm, the second big storm in as many days. It was another medal-filled day for the U.S. at the Olympics. They added four more to its haul. They're tied with Canada for gold, but way ahead on the overall medal count. Asian and European markets are up as we look at the markets. Futures have actually turned down at this point. The Dow gets underway at 10,321. The S&P opens at 1,102, and the Nasdaq opens at 2,234. Coming up, we're going to talk about how Miami has been affected by Haitian students enrolling in Miami schools. That's later in the show. And all this week, Frustration Nation, gridlock in Washington. Is a constitutional amendment able to fix it? You can join the discussion at 8778-MY-TAKE or post to our website, thetakeaway.org. And we're going to take it up with two professors in just a moment.
Too much ideology, not enough practical progress.
People are angry and they are frustrated that perhaps it hasn't been a fast enough change.
Even at a time of enormous national challenge, the people's business is not getting done.
I don't want you to feel discouraged.
I'm as mad as hell and I'm not going to take this anymore.
Yes, in Frustration Nation yesterday, Lynn Scherr and for Celeste Headlee this morning, you could hear them kind of trying to achieve bipartisan consensus at the healthcare reform summit yesterday, sort of.
I definitely think there was an effort. I think that for some of the posturing that was there and all the gimmicks, did you saw they had stacks of bills and papers and
charts.
The president sort of called them on that, which I thought was pretty interesting. But there did seem some individuals who did want to talk about it.
Well, here's Senator Lamar Alexander, a Republican of Tennessee.
And my request is this, is before we go further today, that the Democratic congressional leaders and you, Mr. President, renounce this idea of going back to the Congress and jamming through on a partisan vote through a little used process we call reconciliation, your version of the bill.
But the reconciliation majority vote scenario looks to be the one the Democrats are going to actually use to pass something in 6 weeks, the president said yesterday. And here's why, says Democrat Henry Waxman of California.
Mr. President, you're not going to be able to do this piecemeal, and I have doubts about whether the Republicans are going to help you, because I haven't heard a lot of willingness to come and work with you now, or did I hear it a year ago?
So there you have it. Not much of a compromise, a lot of intent, bipartisanship, not a whole lot in evidence out there in Frustration Nation. Nate Persily, professor of law and political science at Columbia University, joins us. Good morning, Nate.
Good morning.
And Melissa Harris-Lacewell is associate professor of politics and African-American studies at Princeton University. Good morning, professor.
Good morning.
So, Nate, let's talk about amendments to the Constitution. If people are frustrated with the lack of an ability to get things done, even if we are divided between the two parties, is there a constitutional amendment solution, and how would we get there?
Well, if you think passing health care is difficult, amending the Constitution is even more so. And it requires either action from the Congress, so you need two-thirds of each house to pass an amendment that's referred to the states, or you need three-quarters of the state legislatures to recommend a constitutional convention.
So it's worse than the 60-vote majority in the Senate. It's two-thirds. But couldn't the Senate just change its rules on the 60-vote cloture rule without a constitutional amendment?
That's right. But that itself would probably be subject to a filibuster. And so it would require that they allow for a majority vote to overturn the filibuster rule, but it's probably likely that the Republicans would filibuster that change.
All right, I'm dreaming you into a constitutional convention, Nate Persily. What amendment would you pass if you could do it tomorrow to tweak the Constitution?
Well, ironically, the amendment that I'd like to pass is the one that actually the Constitution says you're not even allowed to pass, which is the Constitution, even though it says you can amend it, says that each state shall be guaranteed two votes in the Senate. And actually, the Senate is the most unrepresentative body in, you know, our electoral system. And that is, in many ways, the source of the problem.
And getting more so based on the population shifts in the United States. Melissa Harris-Lacewell, associate professor of politics and African-American studies at Princeton University. What do you think the threshold is for talking about constitutional amendments based on, say, the history in America? Certainly the race question moved from politics into the constitutional amendment question a number of times through our history.
Sure. But let me say, I don't think we're anywhere close to that where we are right now. So I appreciate that all week you all have been talking about the Frustration Nation idea. But frustration is about right. And frustration is not a crisis. Listen, the notion that gridlock or that inefficiency is in and of itself a problem, I think we should pause. Our founders, in part, created a system that is meant to be inefficient, that is meant to not move forward quickly. I can solve gridlock for you with a good authoritarian dictator, right, who just passes rules that the dictator would like, to pass. But that's sort of.
Do you have one in mind? Do you have one in mind?
Yeah, sure. Look, I'd love to just, I'd love to run the country if I could just run it. I certainly don't want to be president and have to compromise with anybody. But if you want to make me dictator for life, I'm happy to take on the job. I'll get you some health care.
All right. So Commissar Lacewell, isn't it true, though, that the rules that preserve the minority's voice in, say, the Senate have morphed over the last generation to be much more obstructionist than they were originally intended to be?
Absolutely. And I do think, again, that frustration is appropriate. It's just that when we start amending the Constitution, we're in a situation that is not just about frustration. It's meant to be something that is more crisis-provoking. For example, the question of slavery, which, of course, divided the nation in a four-year civil war, and in many ways the legacy of which continues to divide the nation. I mean, this anxiety about the Senate, I think, is an appropriate one. I'm not sure that I would do away with the Senate, but I certainly would like to see the end of the Electoral College, which in some ways is also about the Senate. It's also about the fact that states are overrepresented in the Electoral College in the choice of the president, because every state is guaranteed that two Senate voice in the context of choosing the president as well.
And it makes the election a numbers game as well as a referendum on what the people think about. To both of you, but Nate, I'll begin with you. Alvina, one of our listeners in Western Kentucky, says, we should have a parliament-style government where the president can dissolve the parliament if the Congress is not productive and order new elections. There's a constitutional amendment. What do you think of it, Nate?
One of the problems right now is that we have parliamentary parties with a divided government. And if you had a parliamentary government where basically you just had one house of Congress that would be dictating the rules, then you could vote the bums out and you would know what the consequences are. The problem now is that we have cohesive parties that are highly polarized, but we have a governmental system that doesn't allow one party effectively to run its policies through the system.
All right, Nate Persley, professor of law and political science at Columbia University. Melissa Lacewell, or Harris Lacewell, isn't there a problem, though, that if there is too much frustration and things don't get done in traditional mechanisms of government, that there's impetus to move towards a dictatorship, even in the United States, before we go?
Well, I think the real issue is what voters will do, whether or not they will punish the GOP for being obstructionists or punish the Democratic Party for not getting things done.
And they've got the pictures to actually make that case from the healthcare reform summit yesterday. Melissa Harris Lacewell, associate professor of politics and African American studies at Princeton University. Also, thanks to Nate Persley up there at Columbia. And at 15 minutes after the hour, we're not a dictatorship yet. Let's check on some of the stories we're following this morning, Lynn.
John, on morning television today, Republican Senator John McCain has been commenting on yesterday's healthcare meeting in Washington. And that's when President Obama brought together lawmakers from both parties to try to find a compromise on healthcare reform. Senator McCain had this to say on Fox News.
What was not in the room yesterday was American public opinion, which is obviously want us to start over, want us not to pursue this massive $2.5 trillion debt on future generations.
Democrats say they will reassess the situation next week. In New Hampshire, an entire block of the vacation town of Hampton has been destroyed by a fire fanned by winds from a major storm in the Northeast. Firefighter Captain David Lang says it's too soon yet to determine the extent of the damage.
Outside of the fire and the other the damage that was caused by the wind, it's going to be a day or so before we're able to make a full assessment of that.
Hampton is an hour's drive north of Boston.
New Orleans police called it a dark day for the people of the city after a news conference yesterday set out the details of a police cover-up following Hurricane Katrina when two people were shot dead by police on a bridge in the city. Earlier this week, we told you about layoffs and cost-cutting at ABC News. Today, we're learning in the news business that stretched across the pond the troubles, where our partner, the BBC, says it will shut part of its website and close two radio stations to reduce spending there. That's a look at some of the stories we're watching this morning. Coming up, more Frustration Nation, but instead, your advice for young people who are just becoming voters. How would you keep coming-of-age students from getting too cynical? Your voices in just a few minutes.
Hey, you want that to go?
I'm Lynn Scherr in for Celeste Headley for a few days here with John Hockenberry. Hi, John.
Good morning, Lynn.
And now it's time for some takeouts on stories we've been following. Representative Charlie Rangel was one of the last to speak at yesterday's healthcare summit. And shortly after it ended, he was greeted with some very unwelcome accusations by his colleagues in the form of an ethics investigation. Here is Congressman Rangel.
The report further finds that Representative Charles B. Rangel violated the House gift rules by accepting payment for reimbursement for travel to the 2007 and 2008 conferences.
And that, of course, was Charlie Rangel talking about himself and what the accusations are. We are joined now by the Takeaways Washington correspondent, Todd Zwillick, in Washington about this. Todd, this is not good news for the congressman.
No, it's not, but it's better news than he might have expected. I want to take it one step further, Lynn. These are not accusations from the Ethics Committee. This is a conclusion that Charlie Rangel, who is extremely powerful and one of the most senior members of the House, did violate House rules when he allowed a nonprofit to pay for a trip to the Caribbean that he and several other members of Congress went on. That was the nonprofit was backed by several major corporations, Citigroup, Pfizer, Verizon, AT&T, companies like that, that Charlie Rangel knew or should have known that that major corporate sponsors were backing this nonprofit that paid for his trip. That's a violation of House rules.
And Todd, this is not a new set of problems for him. This has been going on for some time.
For some time, and it's not the only set of accusations against him. Charlie Rangel is also under investigation for allegedly improperly using his position as a senior House member to raise money for a Charlie Rangel Institute at the City University of New York. There have been no determinations on those accusations made yet.
And we will keep following this and see what turns up. Thanks, Todd, in Washington. John?
Of course, Charlie Rangel, head of the Ways and Means Committee. That's a huge power shift in Congress if he has to go. We turn now to the Olympics, take out Jason Stallman, Olympics editor for our partner, the New York Times, out there in Vancouver one more time. We talked about medals earlier this morning, Jason, but it seems to me one of the things that has dominated this game is Lindsey Vonn, this great skier, great U.S. skier, but it's more her narrative rather than the emotional content of what's her narrative that's dominated the games rather than her actual skiing. What do you think?
It's an interesting notion, John. You know, going into the games, she was very much the face of the U.S. delegation. She was planning to compete in five events in alpine skiing, considered a medal contender in at least two of those. And so much has happened to her. Before the games even began, she announced that she had an ischial injury that might hold her back. It looks like she's going to compete in all five events. The last one is today. That's the slalom. She's not considered a strong gold medal contender there. She's had some conflict with a teammate, Julia Mancuso. They've competed against each other for a long time. They came up in the same system.
Let's talk about the Vonn versus Mancuso. Here's Lindsey Vonn talking about her sort of emotional stakes in this whole games.
It's amazing. I mean, I've given up everything for this, and it means everything to me. It's why I work hard. It's why I'm in the gym, and, you know, my family's here supporting me, and it's just, it's awesome.
You know, do some of the other members of the team feel that it's Lindsey that gets all the emotional support and maybe they're left in the shadows?
Some of Mancuso's comments have indicated as much. There might be a little bit of a resentment mounting that it seems to be all about Lindsey Vonn for these Vancouver Olympics. Mancuso has the same number of medals. She has two silvers going into the slalom on the final day.
That's interesting. Okay, so Apollo Ohno, how was this games for him?
Apollo Ohno, he has to be happy. He's 27 years old. His aspirations probably are not what they once were. He goes into the last day of competition in short track, having achieved what he set out to achieve in these Vancouver Olympics, and that's come away with the most total medals for an American Winter Olympian. He has seven, and he has a chance to win probably one more in the 500 meters. He's also in a relay, the 5,000 tonight. Americans not expected to do particularly well there.
And is his future endorsements or maybe as an urban messenger? I mean, he is a speed skater.
Who knows what he's going to do? You know, he's been on Dancing with the Stars. He's a charismatic character. And if he does retire from short track, I have to imagine he'll be in the public eye going forward.
Well, he's a blur on skates. And Jason Stallman, thanks so much for being with us this entire Vancouver Olympic Games.
Thank you.
Jason Stallman, Olympics editor for our partner, the New York Times, our own Olympic takeout athlete. Gold medalist, I'd say.
John, our final takeout comes from our lovely listeners. You, all of you out there, heard part of our week-long series, Frustration Nation, just a few minutes ago. But we got some good feedback from you on yesterday's installment. If you're a high school civics teacher, how do you teach good governance with congressional gridlock? And what about if you're a student?
Politics has become more or less about the R or the D behind your name than actually getting anything done.
Oh, wow, that's cynical. That's one of our guests yesterday, Amina Green, a junior at Detroit School of Arts. And to that cynicism, we got some advice that everyone can do.
This is Glenn Maxwell in Detroit. What we have to do as citizens, we vote every 4 years, but in between that, we need to let our representatives and our senators know exactly what we want from them. But you can call, you can write, and you can email your senators and representatives, and it makes a big difference.
Hillary agrees on our site, thetakeaway.org. She posts, citizen action does work. I would like to see students learn more about this. They should be encouraged to speak out and find out they can really make a difference, as they saw during Obama's campaign. And one person said maybe 18 years of age is not the right age for voting.
Because people of that age aren't paying taxes, they don't own property, they don't have children, they aren't married. So none of the things that a real tax-paying voter has to deal with are having to be dealt with by these 18-year-olds. Yet they all feel that they should have a say. And I'm not saying they shouldn't. They need to wait and have a proper say.
But they do go off to Iraq and Afghanistan. I don't know if I buy that one, but call us with your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post a comment on our website, thetakeaway.org. Coming up, Haitian American students entering into Miami schools after the earthquake.
I'm Lynn Scherer, sitting in for Celeste Headley. And coming up, we're following the aftermath of the Haiti earthquake, and we talk about how Miami has been taking in hundreds of Haitian students. That's in a few moments. Here are some of the other news stories we're following at 30 minutes after the hour. Another winter storm, the second in 2 days, is making a mess in the Northeast. Hundreds of flights have been canceled. 500,000 people are without power. Weather Channel meteorologist Chris Warren tells NBC, getting around isn't easy today.
People trying to get into the Northeast today going to have an extremely difficult time flying in. And people here on the East Coast definitely sick of this winter weather.
Oh, yeah, definitely sick of it. The slow-moving storm is expected to continue into the weekend. A big day coming up at the Winter Olympics with 8 medal events on tap. Lindsey Vonn will compete in the slalom wearing a hard plastic brace to protect the right pinky she broke earlier in the week.
At this point, I just hope that my finger's okay. I can still race.
What if she broke the wrong pinky?
That would be bad, yeah. Both hands hold those sticks, you know?
Really,
women's snowboarding and short track speed skating all hit the medal rounds today, and the U.S. men's hockey team squares off against Finland in the semifinals.
Microsoft won one this morning. For the first time, the software company has won approval to secretly shut down a global network of computers that it says fired off more than 1 billion spam emails a day. The judge in the case allowed Microsoft to disable the network, known as a botnet, without warning people running it. So guess what? 10 billionth downloaded song on iTunes. Do you know what the song is?
You asked me if I'll get along.
Kind of a milestone for Johnny Cash's Guess Things Happen That Way. Most downloaded song so far, though, is the Black Eyed Peas' I Got a Feeling. Markets are open now, and after being all over the map this morning, futures up and down. The Dow opens slightly to the positive, up fractionally. The S&P is the same, and also the NASDAQ. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
It's a month and a half after the earthquake in Haiti, but the shock waves still reverberate far beyond the battered island nation. They are especially strong in South Florida, in its schools. With an estimated 21,000 Haitian American students, Miami-Dade schools have felt the impact more perhaps than any other district. In the past month, hundreds of school-age students have left Haiti and enrolled in school in South Florida schools. Hundreds more have needed counseling and special care. We're joined now by Delphine Gervais, a counselor at Miami Edison Senior High School. Good morning, Delphine, and welcome.
Good morning. Thank you.
You are a trust counselor, is that correct?
Yes, I am.
So you help students deal with all kinds of emotional issues, peer pressure, drugs, teen pregnancy. How has the earthquake in Haiti changed the kinds of things you're dealing with?
Well, first of all, I'm located in a school that is predominantly Haitian American descent students. So the impact from the earthquake was immediate, and it's still an ongoing thing. We've had to do from anything from large group assemblies to classroom presentations on grief and loss, as well as the many ongoing individual counseling that we've had to do with students.
And you are Haitian American yourself, correct?
Yes, I am. I'm actually a graduate of Edison Senior High School, and this community has been home to me for many years.
So a very special connection there. We are also joined by Alberto Carvalho, the Miami-Dade County School Superintendent. Good morning, Mr. Carvalho.
Hi, good morning.
I understand you are just back from Haiti. Would you tell us something about what you saw there?
Well, I led a delegation of educators and infrastructure experts to Haiti last Thursday. for a needs assessment. Obviously, we took a tour of the most impacted areas, specifically schools that were destroyed by the earthquake. I think everybody's reaction was one of disbelief, shock, just a horrifying experience. I can tell you that when you drive through streets where every third house collapsed, and when you come upon a school building that used to be five stories high, where 600 children died, and as they're still removing bodies from the rubble, they're burying them directly in what used to be the playground. It certainly is a humbling experience, and it forces all of us to elevate the priority of children in Haiti as our own priority, and that's exactly what we did during that trip.
I know that you have taken in quite a number of Haitian students, students from Haiti as opposed to the Haitian Americans, and our partner WLRN Radio in Miami recently spoke with some of the Haitian students at Felix Varela Senior High School in Miami.
We interact with them, but it's like we prefer being with other Haitians. Like, we feel more at home.
Together we're strong.
Together we're strong. Alberto, how is your school system dealing with all of these new students? Are they sticking together? Can they get along with the other students? And what are their special needs?
I mean, you have to understand, Miami-Dade is probably the America of 10, 20 years from now. We are a minority-majority district. There already teaches 21,000 Haitian-American children. The vast majority of our student population is Hispanic, very strong African-American community, as well as a growing Haitian-American student population. So, we are wired naturally, to deal and teach a very diverse student population. But obviously, typical of a newly arrived group of students, yes, they will congregate together, primarily around the issue of language. But we quickly immerse them in the acculturation into the American society, the American educational system, and they adapt rather quickly. They are children. So I am not concerned about that. What I'm concerned is about the long-term impact, the shock, the psychological effects that the terrifying experience that they lived through and survived will have on their lives. I'm also concerned about the fact that everybody in our school system, children, the 21,000 Haitian children that are already here, as well as a large number of teachers who are related to somebody in Haiti who was impacted by this earthquake, the impact that will have on them for the long haul.
Many, many impacts to worry about. And Delphine, let me turn to you now. In terms of what Alberto was talking about, the impact, let's talk about the short-term impact for a minute. It's a culture shock for so many students. Let's listen to Talia Pilor, who's a Haitian high school student who recently came to the U.S. from Haiti.
Like, they do certain things that in Haiti I would never do. Like, there's no making out aloud in the hallway. There's no disrespecting the teachers. So I just go straight to my Haitian so that I know what I can talk about. Everybody else, it's like a different conversation. It's either like, okay, let's talk about drugs, let's talk about this and that. And I don't, I'm not used to that.
Let's go straight to my Haitians. Delphine, what about that? How do you deal with it?
Well, we're, as Superintendent said, we're meeting with the students regularly, checking up to make sure that as they're going through their days and the ongoing weeks and months, that we're here for them and we're doing what's best for them at this time.
Alberto, I would think some of those values of those Haitian students would be of use to principals in Miami-Dade County.
Well, they absolutely are. This is a culture shock for them. We understand that the relationship between teachers and students in Haiti is very different than that one that often exists in our schools. But they will meet in the middle, and I think we'll be better for it. And I also think that there's a lot about the American public school system that will benefit them.
All right. Thanks so much, Alberto M. Carvalho, superintendent for Miami-Dade County Public Schools, and Delphine Gervais, a counselor at Miami Edison Senior High School. John?
All this week in our series Frustration Nation, we've been talking about gridlock in Washington and attempting to fix it. What have you been getting in the way of ideas?
My name is Cedric Morrison. I'm from Hollywood, Florida. I don't see why we need to amend the Constitution to force a bunch of grown men to do their job.
This is Seneca from Metro Detroit. My remedy for overhauling the Constitution is get rid of the ones that look like they were there when it was written on Capitol Hill, and we can straighten some things out.
That's fantastic. Always, those comments are always welcome. 877-8-MY-TAKE or post to our site, thetakeaway.org. I wasn't around when it was written.
Oh, at 17, what?
Oh, yes, I was a young whippersnapper.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Lynn Sherrin for Celeste Headlee. It happens every 4 years. One dazzling group of athletes widens our eyes and hastens our hearts by sliding down mountains and soaring through the air. Another group takes the ice with, well, brushes. I'm talking, of course, about curling, and so it seems is all of Wall Street. The water cooler chat at New York's top finance firms and investment banks is kizzle-kazzle?
What?
John, I figured you'd know what this is. Here to explain is Eric Dash, a banking reporter for our partner, The New York Times. Hi, Eric.
Hey, it's great to be here.
Good to have you. A banking reporter talking about curling. This is excellent. Okay, first of all, for those of us who are not glued to CNBC all day long, quick, what's your vision of curling? What do you think it really is, and why is it so popular on Wall Street?
Well, my vision is very much like the rest of Wall Street because I see it much the same way. It's on the background of the New York Times, on the monitors hanging above our newsroom, just like it is on the trading floor. And most people on Wall Street have been dazzled just because it's on as well.
So this is a game, as far as I can tell, where they toss something called a stone, and then a couple of people run their brushes on the ice to make it go faster, and then what?
Right. It's almost like darts on ice, or someone described it to me as horseshoes meets housekeeping. And the goal is to sort of get the stone, as they call it, as close to the center target as possible. But nobody really knows the rules. Some people feign that they do.
Yeah, right. Well, let's take a little comic break here. Comedy Central's Stephen Colbert recently visited the U.S. Olympic curling team.
Can you touch your toes?
I can't touch my toes, no.
You cannot touch your toes.
Not really.
I want to point out that you are an Olympic athlete.
Eric, it is a bit slow. I mean, how athletic is this sport?
Well, the folks on Wall Street say it's a thinking man's game. It's slow. It's about precision. It's about strategy. And as Colbert pointed out, it's about the only Olympic event that these armchair athletes could ever envision themselves competing in.
Okay, let's go to one of them. Douglas Cass, president of Seabreeze Partners, joining us from Florida. Douglas, you say curling is like drinking Merlot.
Yeah.
Okay.
I enjoy curling up with a good curling match. But in all seriousness, Eric called me, and I thought he was goofing on me. I thought one of my sons, who I watch curling, had him call me as a joke. But I enjoy the game because it's a combination of bowling. I was on my high school bowling team, shuffleboard, billiards, bocce, chess, and checkers.
No, wait.
I enjoy the strategy and the teamwork.
Hold on, Douglas. You enjoy those games because you like to play them. You are watching this.
No. I admire chess matches in Union Square Park in New York City as much as I admire curling, Olympic curling on CNBC.
Okay, so you can get a charge.
Plus the terms are much more, as you said, you have kizzle-kazzle, and you have all these funny terms.
Let us in on the secret. What is kizzle-kazzle?
Kizzle-kazzle, as I understand it, Eric, is that when you deliver the stone, which you throw, it's intentionally wobbled to compensate for slush or water or snow on the ice surface.
Douglas Cass, thanks for that explanation. President of Seabreeze Partners. Yes, of course, it's interesting. And Eric Dash, finance reporter for our partner, The New York Times. Thanks for joining us. And I'm Lynn Scherr, in for Celeste Headlee, here with John Hockenberry. Coming up, a few weeks ago, we covered the Westminster Dog Show, and we held our own competition. And then the claws came out. Cat people asked, when will we get equal time on the air? Well, we'll do that. And you can enter your feline to the Takeaway Cat Show on our site, thetakeaway.org. We'll talk about the difference between dog and cat people in a few moments.
One has dogs and the other have cats.
It's like the log and the short program.
Yeah, here's a check on leading actual stories here at 48 minutes after the hour on The Takeaway. The economy rocketed ahead at 5.9% growth pace at the end of 2009, stronger than original estimates, although the market seems to be flat this morning, not really reacting much to the news. The growth spurt is due to companies increasing their inventories only in the short term. The same level of growth is not expected in the first quarter of this year. Also this morning, AIG reported a significant fourth quarter loss of nearly $9 billion. but it's not much compared with the nearly $62 billion the company lost in 2008. Financial war brewing now. Libya has made a remarkable pronouncement. Colonel Muammar Gaddafi has called for a jihad or holy war against Switzerland. That's after relations between Libya and Switzerland plummeted in recent weeks over religious issues. To get more, we spoke with the BBC's Sebastian Usher, who's been following the story. He explained why Libya's called for a jihad against the Swiss, of all people.
There's quite a background to this. A row broke out between the Swiss and the Libyans almost a couple of years ago now when one of Gaddafi's sons was arrested with his wife in a Swiss hotel. They were accused of beating up a couple of their servants. Now, the charges were dropped and they were released a couple of days afterwards. But the row, certainly from a Libyan point of view, has never gone away. And the Libyans immediately responded the Gaddafi family removed a large amount of its assets from Swiss bank accounts. It closed itself down to several major Swiss companies in Libya. And it also arrested two Swiss businessmen who happened to be in Libya at the time, saying that their visas weren't in order. They've been held since then. The strange thing about this is before Colonel Gaddafi made this statement yesterday, it looked like maybe things were just about to end on this, because one of the Swiss businessmen had been released and the other one is just now, for the first time, he's serving out the few months of his sentence. So this is a bit of a shock that this has happened now. But, I mean, this is, as I say, a row that's been going on a long time.
Now, there are 500,000 Muslims in Switzerland. Any chance they would actually listen to Muammar Gaddafi on something like this? And there is a religious dimension to this.
I really wouldn't have thought so. I mean, the issue in Switzerland is a big issue. I mean, it's a referendum that was last year on the towers, the minarets.
Building of minarets, right?
Yeah, the building of minarets. It wasn't about mosques. I mean, mosques, that's fine.
But
the minarets, basically, there's a referendum in which a small majority of Swiss said that they were against minarets being built. Now, this hasn't been brought in as law. The government has said that it's opposed to it. Muslims, obviously, there feel that this is a threat against them. But I think they're very unlikely to listen to what Colonel Gaddafi has to say. And I think, to be honest, Muslims across most of the Muslim and Arab world are unlikely to listen that closely to him. I mean, the sort of image that he has in the West as being someone, you know, who speaks very much out of turn, is almost a figure of fun, that isn't that different from how he's regarded in the Muslim world.
Sebastian Usher from our partners, the BBC in London.
Afghan President Hamid Karzai has condemned today's suicide attacks in the center of Kabul. He expressed sadness for the 18 people who were killed. India says at least 9 of its citizens, including government officials, were among the victims. The Taliban has claimed responsibility. Staying abroad, a luxury cruise liner with around 15,000 tourists on board has slammed into a pier at an Egyptian resort on the Red Sea. At least 3 crew members have been killed. At home, Senator John McCain says Republicans are willing to work with President Obama to negotiate changes to the health care bill, but only on a step-by-step basis. McCain tells ABC News yesterday's health care summer was beneficial, but he says it's time to start over.
Finally, in the Northeast, utility companies are working to restore power to more than 500,000 people as a result of a winter storm. Air and road travel have also been seriously disrupted. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Oh, you know what that music means,
right?
As you probably know, our takeaway dog show, to coincide with the Westminster Kennel Club dog show, got a huge response from listeners. Hundreds of you sent in photos of your canines, and even more of you voted for the winner, a Chihuahua named Benny, who was stuck on a cat post in between two Siamese cats. Well, the only complaints we got about the contest were from cat owners who wanted in on our Pet Love Fest. So here is your chance, cat people. Send in photos of your cats for a takeaway cat show.
Oh,
what next, by the way? A
God.
Bird show? Are we doing that next?
Cat pictures on the internet. Whoa.
You can submit photos on our Facebook site or by emailing us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. And all of this got us thinking about the differences between, if you will, cat people and dog people. It turns out psychology professor Sam Gosling, who teaches at the University of Texas, has been thinking about this also. He recently completed a study that will be published later this year in the journal AnthroZoos, all about the personality traits that dog people and cat people express. Sam Gosling joins us from his home in Austin, Texas, and also joining us is the writer Emily Yaffe. She writes the Dear Prudence column for Slate and is author of the book What the Dog Did, Tales from a Formerly Reluctant Dog Owner. I think everybody sort of gets the tone of this segment here. Welcome, Sam and Emily, to both of you.
Thanks a lot.
Good morning.
Emily, let me start with you. So from the title of your book, I gather you're much more of a cat person than a dog person, right?
I am a lifetime cat person who's had a beagle for 9 years.
And?
Well, let's just say that shortly after I got the beagle, I was walking her at 11 p.m. on a rainy night, and she was squatting and straining, and I realized I had to help her. I put a newspaper bag over my hand, performed surgery, and extracted from her the strap of my bra, which had gone missing a few days earlier.
She had eaten your bra.
She had eaten my bra, and in all the decades I'd had cats, I had never had to extract any of my undergarments from them.
Okay, cat versus dog. Let me play a clip that I think might very well sum up the gist of what cat people think of dog people, and tell me if you think Robert De Niro's character in Meet the Parents is on the right track.
You see, Greg, when you yell at a dog, his tail will go between his legs and cover his genitals, his ears will go down. A dog is very easy to break, but cats make you work for their affection. They don't sell out the way dogs do.
Huh.
Huh, indeed. Emily, huh? Is that right?
I think it's totally true. Look, you have to train dogs. It's a lifetime of trying to shape their personality. The cat says, here I am. The training consists of, there's the litter box, guys, and then you just have to accept them on their own terms. I think cats are much more intelligent than dogs because they refuse to let their intelligence be measured.
You don't have to train houseplants either, for heaven's sakes. I hate all pets.
See, you left her speechless.
Obviously, you've never spent the night having a cat sleep on your head like a purring beret. I mean, there's just nothing better than that.
And Emily Liaffe, you've also said that dogs are like little children, cats are like teenagers. Some people might say cats are like girls and dogs are like little boys as well as big boys. Listen to this.
My name is Zachary. I'm from Colombia. I like dogs. Don't like kitties. Don't like the litter in the bathroom. I'd rather stay with a dog. They're supposed to be man's best friends. I can go running with him, pick up a chick in the park, whatnot. You cannot do that with a kitty.
Sam Gosling, associate professor of psychology. Sum it up. What did you find? Who are the dog people? Who are the cat people?
Well, the dog people tend to be higher on three traits from the big five personality dimensions. They tend to be higher on traits known as extroversion, agreeableness, and conscientiousness. And they tend to be the cat people tend to be higher on the traits known as neuroticism and openness. But these are very, very small differences, but they're reliable.
Is it possible to be both a dog and a cat person?
Absolutely, and neither. And those people, both sets of people, tend to fall in between the people who call themselves cat people only and dog people only.
And just for the record, I am a giraffe person. Thank you, Sam Gosling, professor of psychology at the University of Texas at Austin. Emily Liaffe, who writes for Slate and is the author of the book What the Dog Did, Tales from a Formerly Reluctant Dog Owner. And
raw-eating dog.
Yeah, yes. Right. Listen up, cat people. Here is your chance. We are asking folks to send in photos of your cats for a takeaway cat show. You can submit photos on our Facebook site or by emailing us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. You can submit photos until Wednesday morning and vote after that. We'll announce the winner on Friday's show, and we've already gotten some great submissions, so keep
great
them coming.
Great submissions? What would be a bad submission? While you're on
a
site
such a
posting photos of Fluffy and Mia, you can catch up on anything you missed by subscribing to our podcast. You can also get previews on the next day's show by going to our site and clicking blog. I've had cats before, okay? So I come by
I
this
I see
right
you sneezing
way.
Already.
Yes, indeed. All this week in our series, Frustration Nation, we've been talking about gridlock in Washington and how to fix it. Your take at 8778-MY-TAKE or post to our site your constitutional amendment if you think one's needed at thetakeaway.org. Have a great weekend. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Lynn Scherer in for Celeste Headley. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
NYC Now delivers the most up-to-date local news from WNYC and Gothamist every morning, midday, and evening. With three updates a day, listeners get breaking news, top headlines, and in-depth coverage from across New York City. By sponsoring programming like NYC Now, you'll reach our community of dedicated listeners with premium messaging and an uncluttered audio experience. Visit sponsorship.wnyc.org to get in touch and find out more.